Hello and welcome to the Soccer History USA podcast. On today's episode, the first women's game. On December 3rd, 1893, at San Francisco's Central Park, the Colleen Braunns and the Bonnie Lassies met in the first documented women's soccer game in the United States. Although women had been playing football since before the arrival of the Europeans and undoubtedly participated in various types of football games all throughout the 18th and 19th century, the match in San Francisco in 1893 is the first known game played according to the association rules, or what we today know as soccer. On today's episode, I'd like to talk a little bit about the development of women's sports in the second half of the 19th century and explain a little bit about how and why the game took place. I argue that it's part of a broader cultural change that took place in the United States, along with the development of a sporting and entertainment culture in San Francisco that included soccer, both men's and women's. The second half of the 19th century saw the development of commercialized mass sport, especially in the United States and in Great Britain. This commercialized mass sport was, however, generally limited to male leagues, and women were denied access to formal league-based competitions. Instead, individual sports, although even those could be also limited in certain ways, as we'll see in a few minutes, and non-competitive athletic activities were deemed more appropriate for women. Historian Susan Kahn makes the distinction or describes a distinction that emerges between what was known as manly sport and female exercise. And there was a genuine belief among medical officials and others that too much exercise was potentially damaging to women, both physically, it could have prevent their ability to bear and raise children, and morally. The second half of the 19th century also saw some changes that began to open up the playing field and allow women to participate in sports and in more sports than were generally available previously. We see shifts in medical views. It was no longer viewed as absolutely detrimental to women's health to participate in moderate athletic activities. We also see the development and the founding of women's colleges and a general rise in female attendance at universities and colleges in general. So in 1870, there were about 11,000 female college students in the United States, and by 1900, there were 85,000. Also, we see the training and the emergence of a number of female physical education instructors who would go out and take jobs at these universities or other schools and educational institutions and begin to provide instruction in athletic activity and sports to women and young girls across the country. At times, these rules of certain types of games might be altered in the belief that they were too rough or too complex or too difficult for women to master. And there were certain sports that were deemed more appropriate and thus allowable for women to participate in. And these included games like field hockey, basketball after its development, tennis, and general athletic activities or physical education, or what we might call calisthenics, were also acceptable. A distinction increasingly became made between what were respectable sports or athletic activities, and these were generally ones that were available to and were played by middle and upper class women. And then there was another world of disreputable or maybe borderline sports that were, or activities, athletic type activities that were mainly the domain of working class women. So respectable sports included things like cycling, croquet, equestrian sports, golf, and tennis. All of those sports obviously require either large open spaces or specially prepared grounds or access to expensive equipment like bicycles or horses. And these were generally the kinds of sports that tended to be practiced at the universities. Then we have, on the other hand, the disreputable sports, or those that were kind of on the moral border, the border between respectability and not. And these might include women participating in what were known as the manly sports. So, for instance, female boxers were obviously right out, or those that competed regularly against men. And then we have some that, again, were sort of straddled the border. One, for example, is a woman named Etta Hatton, who worked under the stage name Jaguarina. And she was a trained fencer who participated in a number of mounted sword battles against men. And this was a strange sport or competition that was incredibly popular in the later half of the 19th century. Other sports or activities that kind of straddled the line, as I mentioned, included participation in what were viewed as men's sports. So in the 1880s, an effort was made to organize a traveling women's baseball team, but it ultimately collapsed amid fears that it was really simply a front for prostitution, and also because the organizer, the manager of the club, took off with all of the club's money. These efforts in the United States were also taking place in the English-speaking world overseas. So, for example, in 1886-87, a women's Australian cricket team saw some success touring around the continent, at one point drawing 15,000 people to a single match. In 1890, in England, you had the original lady cricketers who toured again for about a year before that ultimately collapsed. The first known women's soccer game took place in 1881 in Edinburgh, Scotland, and ultimately the two teams played about 8 known matches. Initially, press reports and I suppose we could also say crowd reception, as far as we can tell, was fairly sympathetic. This was viewed as some kind of a novelty. But over time, and later matches were marred by pitch invasions, by outright crowd hostility, and by overall bad press. There's a gap of 5 or 6 years here, but there were other efforts made in various parts of England. There was a single game documented as being played in 1887. And then in the city of Sunderland in 1889, there seems to have been some activity, including mention of a Canadian women's football team, although there's no documentation to support the existence of such a club. And few, if any, of these teams that seem to have emerged in Sunderland played any documented 11 versus 11 games. So it's a sketchy sort of history beyond those first 8 known matches in Scotland. Now, in California, we can see, and San Francisco in particular, that many of these broader themes and cultural trends were also playing out in the city by the bay. So there were reputable sports that were organized as early as 1863. There were groups, associations like the St. Andrews Society and the Caledonian Club that were holding annual games. And these included all sorts of traditional Scottish games, primarily for men, but also included races for boys and for girls. The University of California had a young ladies' tennis club from 1890, and an event took place in October 1893, just a few months before the women's soccer teams took the field at the Schützen Club. The club had a ladies' day where they invited the wives of the members to come and shoot for a day at the club. And the newspaper reports that the members initially joked this would be, you could just imagine them sort of ha-ha-ing, that this was going to be, quote, a humorous fiasco, unquote. But as the day went on, the women, it was obvious, took this very seriously and saw this as an opportunity to demonstrate their skill. And by the end of the day, the men were amazed and surprised at how much better the women were at shooting than they had supposed going in. San Francisco also saw its share of these kind of borderline athletic activities. So the famous Jaguarina, for instance, defeated a known, well-known San Franciscan Sergeant Owen Davis in one of those mounted sword matches in 1887. And another famous female sportswoman, I guess we could call her, was named Lillian Smith. And she had been born in California, and reportedly at age 10, she got sick of playing with dolls and asked her father to buy her a rifle. And she soon became one of the nation's foremost and most famous shooters. Eventually, she joined Buffalo Bill's show and toured Europe in the 1880s. She developed an intense rivalry with more well-known now, Annie Oakley. And the press often made a distinction between Annie Oakley, who was seen as perhaps more cultured, and Lillian Smith, who was generally described as being a kind of uneducated bore. And by 1893, Lillian Smith was back in San Francisco, and there is, in fact, on the roster of women participating in the soccer game in December, there is a Lillian Smith listed, but it's doubtful that it was the same person. Many of these athletic activities took place at Central Park in San Francisco. This was an entertainment complex created in 1884, and it was run by a man named Daniel McNeil, who was better known as D.R. McNeil. The main income of Central Park was its use as a stadium, and it had a grandstand and a large field. But also on the site was a saloon, a restaurant, and candy and cigar stores. So it was sort of an all-purpose commercial athletic facility, maybe far ahead of its time. As far as athletic competitions or events, I guess we might say, they put on wrestling matches, tugs of war, pedestrian races, balloon ascensions, and other sorts of activities that to us seem fairly odd, but were incredibly popular in the late 19th century. And they also put on broad theatrical productions, like one that was called The Fall of Pompeii. They also leased the field to the Men's Association Football League that began play in 1892. And I'll have more to say about that in a future podcast. So the idea for a Women's Association football game seems to have been dreamed up by D.R. McNeil sometime in November of 1893. And he thought, oh, I'll hold this women's football game. And undoubtedly, he viewed it as a novelty and one that would attract crowds. And so at least initially, it was designed as a money-making venture, which is not unusual because that was, in fact, similar ideas often surrounded the formation of women's football clubs in England, or indeed the lady cricketers in England and Australia. He told the newspaper that he chose the association rules because other football codes he thought were too violent. And if the women participated in intercollegiate football, as gridiron football was called, or rugby, or even Gaelic football, a veritable slaughter would result. Even though it was put on as a novelty and undoubtedly to make money, it was not a farce. There were managers of two of the Men's Association Football League clubs were assigned to coach and to train the players before they stepped out on the field. They held practices before the games, and the winning team was going to be awarded a silk banner. So although it was set up as a novelty, it was not designed to be exclusively a joke or to make fun. Now, who were the players or who were the women who decided that they wanted to take on this task? Well, a couple of weeks before the games were scheduled to take place, the newspaper ran an advertisement for a number of active young ladies, and that anyone interested was to inquire at Central Park and to talk to one of the managers of these clubs. So it could have been anyone in the city who saw the advertisement or heard about what was going on. The newspapers include at several points listings of names of women who participated or were scheduled to participate in the games, but these lists are often unreliable. Similar challenges plague historians and researchers who want to talk about the history of the men's game, in that these names are often incomplete. They often include alternate spellings depending on the day, and of course, they usually include omissions. Men who were on, or women or players who were on these rosters may or may not have participated in the actual games. In addition, the women's teams, they may have used pseudonyms, like some other female athletes did when participating in these events that were, as I mentioned earlier, kind of on the border of respectability. Another problem in identifying who these women were is that a lot of the names were quite common. So, for instance, one of the players listed was Annie Johnson. And looking through the city directories, I found 10 Annie Johnsons listed in San Francisco. One teacher, one weaver, one nurse, one simply listed as Mrs., three widows, and three who were domestic workers. So the Annie Johnson, who may or may not have participated in the game, could have been one of these 10 women, or maybe none of them at all. It's likely that the players came from a mixture of both middle and lower class young women. I could reasonably identify with some certainty about 8 players, 4 of whom worked as domestics, including that might include a maid or a cook. 2 were actresses, and 2 had other occupations. Others who can be identified maybe less assuredly included a clerk, a couple of dressmakers, and maybe a few widows. So some of these women likely were or came from the margins of society. So, for instance, there was a woman named Edna Huntington, and that could have been the same teenager who was later arrested twice in just over a year, once for disturbing the peace and once for being found in the company of a man at a boarding house. Edna Huntington was ultimately sentenced to the reformatory. Some of these women may have come from the middle class. Was the Bessie Gardner, who was listed as a player, the same one who later competed in local equestrian and tennis competitions? That might indicate that she was more of the middle class, since those sports generally involved a more significant outlay of money that would not have been available to a working class woman. I really like the idea that Helen Anderson, who may have played for the Colleen Bawns, later was the same Helen Anderson who turned up at a meeting of the Equal Rights for Women League. But again, there's no way to know for sure. So game day arrives, and the San Francisco Call, which was one of the city's leading newspapers, described it as a festive occasion. They said there were colorful posters lining the walls of Central Park advertising the match. They described a crowd of several thousand who attended. The crowd was in extremely good spirits. They brought fish horns, which were common at baseball and soccer games during this period. They were kind of the 19th century version of the vuvuzela. It was part of the women's game was scheduled to take place before one of the men's games in the local association league. The press coverage was generally positive and not terribly critical overall. And one headline, in fact, read, "A healthy pastime on a healthy day in which femininity displays power of endurance." The match kicked off at 2 p.m., and the women wore what was described as cycling clothing, loose-fitting jerseys and knickerbockers, and most of them were wearing tennis shoes. They did not wear the long skirts, corsets, and other restrictive clothing that was generally dubbed both fashionable and appropriate for women to wear when they were out in public. There was some derision. I guess the match report included some derision at comical failed kicks, general running about without any seeming purpose. And there was some criticism of those few players who chose to wear high heels instead of tennis shoes. But there was also praise for what was described as some astonishingly good plays. Florence Day Montgomery, Catherine Howard, Addie Beaufort, and Josie and Katie Coster were the stars of the match, with Beaufort and Josie Coster scoring the only two goals, giving the victory to the Colleen Bawns. It's also interesting that the match reports praises both offensive prowess at times with some of the players and also defensive work by some of the other women. Another match was played on December 10th and drew 2,500 people to see this match. Although, unlike the previous one, where there was a great description of the events and the match itself, the San Francisco Call decided there was nothing noteworthy about the second game. Although the newspaper said that this was not noteworthy, I would argue just the opposite, that it is noteworthy in the sense that these games seem to have attracted little negative reaction, despite the fact that women were wearing what was known as rational clothing and performing or participating in a sport that was generally dubbed to be more of a masculine pastime. I could find no condemnations of these players or the games and no real protests about what was going on. And there was some condescension, as I mentioned in the press, but also some real acknowledgement that the women could and did play the game with skill, even though they had little preparation or training beforehand. What do we know, if anything, about the players? What were their thoughts about this game? What were their experiences having taken part? Well, since we know little information about who, or we can identify very few of the players with any real certainty, we obviously don't know anything at all about their experiences or thoughts. It was reported that they were paid $2 a match, and the advertisement I mentioned earlier was filed under the Female Help Wanted section of the classified ad portion of the newspaper. Now, $2 a match is an amount that would have been pretty good pay depending on your occupation. So for a maid or a cook, a domestic worker, that would be the equivalent of several days' pay. But it's not great. It's not an overwhelming amount of money. And so likely there was more than just a desire to earn a few bucks, although that probably didn't hurt, and that was undoubtedly the prime motivator for some of the women. And for middle-class women, $2 a match was probably not a real significant consideration. So if we think about it, these women had to answer an advertisement in the newspaper that simply said they were looking for active women. It didn't specify that this was for a football match. And then once they found out, they had to agree to take on the role of participating and playing in a game in public before potentially thousands of people. And they didn't know beforehand what the reaction of the crowd might be to their playing in this game. This was a role, of course, that, if the newspaper reports are to be believed, some of the women excelled at and played extremely well under enormous amounts of pressure. So I think that some of these women undoubtedly saw this as an opportunity to participate in this broader sporting culture that had been emerging in San Francisco and across the United States in the second half of the 19th century. Some of them undoubtedly wanted to challenge themselves physically and to take up this, what was likely a new sport. And undoubtedly, some of them simply wanted to have fun. Thank you for listening to the Soccer History USA podcast. For episode notes, please visit the website at www.soccerhistoryusa.org and follow me on Twitter at Soccer History US.